You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.
In this episode, we'll be looking at the current guidelines on the pre-hospital management of drowning and the academic research that underpins these principles. We will explore the epidemiology of drowning and examine patient outcomes as a group. We will also discuss the important wider efforts in public awareness and prevention. To do this, I have Professor Mike Tipton with me. Mike is a household name in the surf lifesaving community and is one of the leading UK academics on drowning. He currently leads the Extreme Environmental Laboratory at the University of Portsmouth and has spent over 40 years working in the areas of thermoregulation, environmental and occupational physiology. This includes as a consultant in survival and thermal medicine to both the RAF and UK Sport. He's been heavily involved in the RNLI for many years as a consultant advisor to the Medical Directorate. In 2018, he was awarded an MBE for services to physiological research in extreme environments. Welcome to the podcast, Mike.
Hello, Alec. Nice to be here.
So first off, Mike, could you tell us a little bit about what first drew you to study how the human body responds in extreme conditions, particularly drowning?
Yeah, I guess everyone has a pretty inherent interest in how their body works. And I grew up doing quite a lot of sport, and one of the sports I did quite a lot of was swimming. And, you know, as a consequence of which, you get interested in how to get fitter, how to get faster, how to do better. And I then went off and did, I ended up doing a master's in human and applied physiology at King's College, which took me to the Institute of Naval Medicine, where I met a guy called Frank Golden. And Frank was doing studies at the time on swim failure in cold water. And I had developed an interest in temperature regulation and thermal physiology. I had a background as a swimmer, for a competitive swimmer, for about 10 years, even though I'm completely the wrong shape for it, but there we are. So these two worlds collided, and I volunteered for the study. I swam for 20 minutes wearing a boiler suit in 5-degree water. Frank had, and the rest of the lab had bet that I wouldn't get past 3 minutes. So I won some credibility by doing that. And then I went on to do a PhD with the Royal Navy, looking at human adaptation to cold. And that was it, really. I was doing stuff, you know, found my passion, really, I guess, which is an important step in life.
Yeah, that's great. That's really good stuff. Could you talk us a bit through the drowning process? What happens when somebody drowns, Mike, including the pathophysiology from the point of submersion?
Yeah, sure. So let's start by getting the definition sorted out, because that before 2002, there were 13 different published definitions of drowning, near drowning, dry drowning, and they were all got rid of in 2002, where they were replaced by the definition of the process of experiencing respiratory impairment from submersion or immersion in a liquid, with only three outcomes: death, no morbidity or morbidity. And so terms like near drowning, dry drowning, secondary drowning were all got rid of, although you will still see them in the literature, but they have been redundant for over 20 years now. The drowning process itself, we've just published a paper in the Medical Legal Journal, if people want to go and read a bit more about this, which I'm sure we'll link to. And it talks about the experience of drowning, which underpins quite a lot of medical legal cases where you talk about how long it takes to drown and the experience of drowning, which ties directly into things like compensation. And we wrote the paper to avoid having to go through what was a particularly tortuous discussion, really. But there are six stages of the process of drowning. There's a struggle to keep the airway clear of the water. And we've been involved in research fairly recently looking at the different actions that people perform on the surface, from the instinctive drowning response, which is quite difficult to spot, to people just disappearing under the water, to backward milling, to ladder climbing. So, you know, we've characterized those actions associated with struggling. Then there's a breath hold. And then there's the aspiration of water, normally follows swallowing. Most drowning victims swallow water, which is why quite a lot vomit when you come to do any kind of resuscitation, or even without resuscitation. There's over 60% vomit. It's closer to 90% if you're doing CPR. Then after the aspiration of water, there's unconsciousness, cardiorespiratory arrest, and then death and inability to revive. And each one of those has its own time period, which can vary depending on the circumstances. Somebody forced under the water in a ditched inverted craft, or are they struggling at the surface before they go under the water? Is the water cold? Are the breath hold times short or long? So, you know, there's no, you know, it's a very, very flexible feast in terms of the different periods. And we've tried to explain that in the paper. Generally, you know, in cold water, a breath hold time might be 1 or 2 seconds. With warmer water, it might go up towards a minute. Normally, after the aspiration of water, there's around about 75 seconds before unconsciousness occurs. And then if you look at the work of Fainer back in the 50s, you'll be talking about going into respiratory arrest around about 70 or 80 seconds and cardiac arrest, or you know, a fall in blood pressure, which starts at about 2 minutes and is complete within about 200 seconds, so just over 3 minutes. The pathology that you mentioned, obviously there's a lung pathology. It's important to note that there's, although you'll read in the academic literature quite a lot about the difference between saltwater and freshwater drowning, essentially, if somebody is going to be recoverable, it's pretty much the same problem. They're going to be hypoxic, and they're going to be acidotic and hypercapnic, maybe through slightly different mechanisms. In salt water, the water stays in the lung, and by osmosis draws more in. In fresh water, it can get absorbed, and the lung can look like it's dry, which is where we start to get the myths about dry drowning, and laryngospasm and things like that. They're probably a very, very small percentage. And in any case, something like a laryngospasm isn't going to remain extant once you become profoundly hypoxic. So your lung pathology is essentially the washing out of surfactant or the damage of the lining of the alveoli. Basically, you stop gas exchange and you become, as I say, hypoxic, hypercapnic, and acidotic, which results in loss of consciousness, respiratory arrest, and cardiac arrest and central nervous system's neurologic damage. And in fact, that's the most important bit. The neurophysiological responses are vital because that's going to determine the extent to which you can be recovered. I will talk a bit more about that later, I'm sure. But that's one of the reasons why one of the prognostic indicators is the temperature of the water, because of the protection you can get by rapid cooling of the brain. The cardiac response is quite important. That goes from tachycardia to bradycardia to pulseless electrical activity to asystole. And it's worth noting that ventricular fibrillation, the incidence of ventricular fibrillation or ventricular tachycardia is low, about 4.5% to 6% with drowning. And that has some implications for the speed with which you would, you know, rush for the defibrillator. And you certainly wouldn't prioritize that over addressing the hypoxic challenge, which people are suffering because they're essentially suffocating, either because they are suffering from atelectasis because the fresh water has washed out the surfactant, or because the alveoli are full of salt water. And then I guess the other point to note is that one of the reasons the definition was changed is because drowning is a process. For some of us, that process starts with ignorance in a community. For others, it starts with that aspiration of water. But it's a process that can go on after you've left the water. Now, people will have heard of this in terms of the redundant term of secondary drowning. It's essentially just drowning, that the water that's gone into the lung has now aggravated the lung, and you get an inflammatory response, and that inflammatory response makes the condition worse with time. It's again worth noting that there is no case in the medical literature of a patient who underwent clinical evaluation and was initially without symptoms who deteriorated and died more than 8 hours after the incident. So now generally the advice is drowning can take up to 4 hours and you watch for 8 hours. And you're keeping your eye on troubled breathing, chest pains, low energy, irritability, persistent coughing, you know, all the things you'd expect from somebody whose lung function is being impacted in a negative way.
So I'm all right in thinking there, Mike, from what you just said, that all of these cases of sort of delayed drowning, if you like, that they're all preventable, then they all present with symptoms, hypothetically.
Yeah. I mean, there's a long list of those symptoms, but they essentially are all to do with, lung function disruption and increasing hypoxia. And of course, from that pathophysiological review, if you like, it becomes quite clear that the relief of hypoxia is your primary aim in the out of hospital, pre-hospital treatment of drowning, and it has the greatest impact on outcome. So every minute CPR is delayed, there's a 10% less chance of success. So your pre-hospital peripheral saturation oxygen goal is about greater than 92%. Tracheal intubation, if possible, high inspired oxygen, PEEP, if possible, 5 centimeters of water. And things like, don't worry too much about the foam. Don't waste time attempting to suction out the foam. Avoid head down abdominal thrusts and Heimlich maneuvers, finger sweep as necessary. And then, as we've already touched on, ventricular fibrillation is rare in drowning. So you certainly wouldn't prioritize getting a defibrillator on and in place over oxygenation.
Thanks, Mike. I was wondering if you could talk us through some of the typical presentations of drowning cases in the UK. I know certainly some of my colleagues who work in urban areas for ambulance services or perhaps rurally on the coast might have come across different cases. Could you maybe talk through some of the typical presentations we see generally in the UK?
Yeah, they're very varied, of course. They range from all different water types. Roughly half the drownings we see in the UK are inland waterways and half are at the coast. But then you've got a very small percentage where in things like swimming pools. You've got, I've seen them in nappy buckets, garden ponds. If you look at it in terms of those who drown, generally the higher categories are males, children under the age of 14. So, worldwide, we know that about 25% of those that die are very young. Under the age of 4, and about coming up for 40% are under the age of around about 16. There's a greater risk for people with epilepsy, for example, and that's 15 to 19 times greater risk. It's associated with alcohol use, low income, poor education, rural residency, risky behavior, lack of supervision. And in terms of the precipitating events, as I've already alluded to, sort of a syncope or seizure, circulatory arrest. And then there was an interesting paper by Dunn et al. A few years ago, 2022 now, where one third of drownings in Canada had a pre-existing medical condition. So, these are some of the characteristics of those that drown, but it's a very varied feast in terms of location.
That's brilliant, thank you. It's getting to that time of year again where the temperatures drop in, and I think we've got snow even forecast for some parts of the UK at the end of this week. Could you tell us a bit about cold water shock, and why is this so important in terms of how it leads to death.
Yeah, so when we first started, like in the Jurassic period many years ago, the preoccupation was with hypothermia. Everybody thought that it was hype. You know, if you ask somebody what happened when somebody went into cold water, oh, they become hypothermic. And you'd read in the newspapers, you know, that somebody became hypothermic in 4 minutes. That's just a physical impossibility. An adult human being won't be able to lose sufficient heat from what is a fairly large mass in anything less than about 30 minutes. So if anybody's dying before 30 minutes, it's probably not hypothermia. There are some special circumstances that we'll probably talk about. But anyway, then you sort of read that about two-thirds of those that died were regarded as swimmers, and 60% died within 2 or 3 meters of a safe refuge. So something pretty rapid was happening, and that led us to look at the changes that occurred with a sudden fall in skin temperature. And that sudden fall in skin temperature stimulates the peripheral cold receptors, the cutaneous cold receptors that are about 0.18 millimeters per surface below the surface of the skin, and produces a gasp response of 2 to 3 liters, and uncontrollable hyperventilation, a peripheral vasoconstriction, an increase in cardiac output, which those two combine push up blood pressure significantly. So, I mean, we will typically see in the first minute of immersion with that sudden fall in skin temperature, as I say, a gasp of 2 to 3 liters, 66 breaths per minute of uncontrollable breathing frequency, 114 liters of air being shifted in and out of the lung, and a heart rate of about 156 beats per minute of somebody sitting still. And we called it cold shock. Because not because of the medical definition of shock, but simply because it's a shocking thing to have happen. It's you know, and people know about this. I mean, it's the stuff I've just talked about is essentially the neurophysiological correlate of it's okay once you're in. You know, you get this big initial response, which then those receptors adapt within the first minute or so, and you've now got your breathing back under control. The problem is that the lethal dose of water into the lung, salt water, for an average individual is around about 1.5 litres. And that first gasp is over 2 litres. So your first breath in as you fall from a height or as a wave breaks over your face is potentially sufficient to get you well down the road to the drowning process. And so we've spent quite a lot of time warning people about cold shock, telling people how to avoid cold shock, designing emergency breathing systems, physiological interventions in terms of cold habituation and behavioral interventions to try and minimize that impact. We know that roughly 60% of those that die in the UK on an annual basis die from those short-term responses, as opposed to longer-term responses, about 20% dying from hypothermia and about 20% dying actually just before, shortly after rescue, which is another interesting phenomenon.
And Mike, am I right to believe this is often the cause behind a lot of these deaths that we see for young males swimming in the summer in quarries and things like that? Is it to do with water depth and water temperature? Is that correct?
Yeah, so the water temperature is at its coldest early summer because it's very slow to warm up and very slow to cool down. Whereas, of course, the air, being a different physical fluid, warms up much quicker and cools down much more quickly. So actually, the sea has been at its warmest through September and October and will be at its coldest through April and May. But of course, that's what happens is the air temperature shoots up and everyone starts to leap into cold water. And so, yes. Now, and of course, there are inland waters that are even colder because, as you say, they're shallower. They may have some mountain water drainage. And then you can start very easily getting water temperatures down into low single figures. That cold shock response I've just spoken about peaks in water somewhere between 15 and 10 degrees Celsius for a normally clothed individual. Now, you know, that's 15 degrees Celsius is quite high. I mean, that's if we don't get much above that around the coast of the UK, the average water temperature around the UK is about 12 degrees Celsius. So the cold shock response is always going to be there to some extent. As the water gets up into the higher teens, it's just a less profound response that's more easily controllable and comes back under control more quickly. The problem is, once it gets below 15, that it starts to be a bigger response that becomes uncontrollable for longer. And so you've got less chance of protecting your airway in particular. And so for otherwise young, fit, healthy individuals, as like the type you've mentioned, the young, particularly the young male playing around in quarries, it's the respiratory response. For older, that is the particular hazard. For older individuals, it can easily be the cardiovascular responses that are potentially hazardous.
And I know that obviously cold water therapy has been very popularized recently. Talking around body habituation, I've seen a lot of your videos from the University of Portsmouth with I think some former special forces soldiers and athletes all being dunked into the ice bath to watch the physiological effects it has on them. How much does body habituation prevent this cold water shock?
Yeah, very significantly, Alec. It's the videos you've seen probably have included some open water swimmers like Lewis Pugh, who came to our lab, who was swimming along the south coast. He was swimming the length of the width of the channel as opposed to across it. And when you drop the average individual into water, you'll see gasping, hyperventilation, tachycardia, hypertension, all the things I've mentioned. When you drop Lewis Pugh into the water, you don't even know where he's gone in. If you're not looking at him, you're looking at the trace, it's hard to see where he's gone from air to water. And so you can get quite a profound habituation of that cold shock response. It takes as few as 6 3-minute immersions to halve that response. And when we've looked at that periodically after the initial reduction of 50%, 14 months later, we still saw in individuals who came to the lab a reduction that was 25%. So, I mean, they wouldn't come after that. We sort of ran out of friends after 14 months. They'd had enough. So it's a fairly permanent alteration, and it's occurring more central than the peripheral cold receptors, because we've done bizarre studies like immersing one half of the body repeatedly to habituate to cold. And then if you turn that person over and you put the other half of the body in that's never been in the cold water, you still see the habituation to cold. So it's a more central phenomenon than the peripheral cold receptors. And it may well have a psychological component. Normally what you find is people go into cold water, they are fairly ignorant of what water temperature means because they immediately translate it to air temperature. So if I say to you, oh, the water's at 13, you'll think, well, 13's not too bad, you know. But of course, 13 degree water is quite different to 13 degrees air because of the physical characteristics of the two. And so most people we see are most anxious about their second immersion because they've now had the experience of the first one. Despite your best efforts to get informed consent, it's really difficult to explain what going into cold water is like. It's like trying to explain toothache, you know, until you've had it, you don't really know what it's about. So anyway, but it does show a significant habituation. That significant habituation is quite permanent. What I should say is that after the skin has cooled, the next tissues to cool are the superficial nerves and muscles. And that leads to physical incapacitation. So we'll see, we've done studies, you can see again the videos online, of Olympic standard swimmers, people like Sharon Davis, Duncan Goodhue. So we've done some work with Swedish world record holders. And after that skin cooling, after that peripheral neuromuscular cooling occurs, they just become physically incapacitated. And that can happen in very cold water in as little as 10 to 20 minutes. Now, the problem with that particular response is there's no habituation to it. That'll just occur time and time again because it's not a direct effect of cold on nerves and neuromuscular junctions and muscles. So it just doesn't show any habituation.
And am I right in thinking, Mike, in some of your papers, you described this almost as like a tetany. Is that correct? That's the sort of the kind of almost what happens, like a tetanic spasm.
Yes, you can get tetany from the hyperventilation that occurs on initial immersion because you're blowing off a lot of carbon dioxide. But then you'll find that as you get cooler, you just lose the ability to contract the muscle. Early on, in cold, you'll actually be activating agonistic and antagonistic muscles at the same time. So you become very stiff. And then after a while, you just lose the ability to swim. And classically, what we teach people who, for example, are doing medical cover for open water events is to watch for the person that goes from horizontal to more upright in the water, because there is a classic, staged transition from being swimming to being in one of those drowning prevention behaviors. And that is, you become more upright, your sinking force increases, your drag increases, your power output decreases. And then eventually you get to the point where you're doing, you're climbing the ladder as they go, you're back milling, just trying to keep your airway clear of the water. And it's a very reproducible profile that you go through.
Well, it's really interesting and, so useful to think about the context where, for us as pre-hospital clinicians, we might come across these type patients. Staying on cold water for a second, there are case reports of young people having been submerged in cold water for prolonged periods, having survived neurologically intact. I think typically these are up in Scandinavian countries, certainly the case reports that I've seen. Could you talk a bit about the pathophysiology behind this? And are there any other positive prognostic factors when it comes to drowning?
Okay, so let's start with the prognostic indicators. So I've said that, there are six stages of drowning and the last one is failure to revive. And so you go into cardiorespiratory arrest. But we know that if your submersion has been less than 5 minutes, there's a reasonable chance of recovery with little or no neurological impairment. If it goes up to 10 minutes, then death or severe neurological impairment is seen in about 56% of the cases. That still means there's 44 where that's not seen. So the general, if you look across the literature, the general time for instigating effective, and that's the other point to make, it has to be effective, obviously, CPR, is about 10 minutes after following submersion. And I think, as I say, there's a fair amount of evidence to support those kind of numbers. Now, your other prognostic indicators are going to be, one of them is temperature. So, for example, if the water temperature is below 6 degrees, then there's more likely to be a positive outcome. I'll come back to that in a minute. No aspiration. If it's a child, the prognostic outcome is, or the prognostic indicator for outcome is better. We've talked about time to basic life support being less than 10 minutes, being neurologically intact on arrival at the hospital. If you've got a cardiac arrest that responds to first aid at the scene and you get early return of spontaneous circulation, a minimum blood pH of greater than 7.1, blood glucose lower than 11.2 millimoles per litre. Now, coming back to the cold water, there are these miraculous survivals, or at least they were called that, where people had been taken from under water and made an almost full recovery after 30 minutes, 35 minutes. And we were asked to look into this because the search and rescue community had heard about these occurrences and it was pretty unclear as to what to do. So we did a big review, which was published in Resuscitation in 2011, which gave a decision-making guide. And it involved looking at as many incidents as we could find, literally thousands of drowning incidents, where we were trying to see what the outcome was. And we identified a temperature of about 6 degrees water temperature, where above 6 degrees, you really didn't see very prolonged submersions resulting in, you know, a good outcome. The longest times we saw were around about 20 minutes of submersion. Once you got below 6 degrees, all of a sudden there was a step that you would start to see these longer submersions. So the longest that we've seen is 2.5-year-old child in the US with 66 minutes of submersion with recovery. And we think that the reason for that is rapid brain cooling. Now, Ian, I've already said it's a physical impossibility for an adult to become hypothermic in less than 30 minutes. However, we postulated at the time that it was the actual process of the cold shock response and flushing water in and out of the lung because of the uncontrollable hyperventilation may well mean the lung becomes a heat exchanger, and you cool the lung, you cool the heart and the carotid artery supply to the brain, and you thereby selectively cool the brain, which we know, obviously, if you cool the brain, you extend its hypoxic survival time because it's decreased metabolism. The only evidence that we could have for that was that a guy called Al Kahn in Seattle had done some work looking at cooling in terms of the falling carotid artery temperature after 2 minutes in water at 4 degrees C, and showed that in the first 2 minutes you could lower carotid artery temperature by around about 8 degrees Celsius, as opposed to just 0.8 of a degree Celsius if there was no submersion involved. Once cardiorespiratory arrest had occurred, the cooling rate plummeted, and so it was much, much slower. So between 2 and 10 minutes, there was then about a 2.4 degree fall in carotid artery temperature. So that seemed to point to the cardiorespiratory responses being part of the cooling mechanisms. So this is a selective brain cooling system. There's no way can you cool quick enough from the surface to get this protection. But if you can lower brain temperature by about 7 or 8 degrees in that first couple of minutes, now you've now doubled the hypoxic survival time from about 5 to 10 minutes to about 20 minutes. And that now gives sufficient time for some surface cooling to take effect. So we think that's why when you see these long-term submersion survivals, they're two-thirds of them are children under the age of 12. And if they are adults, they tend to be very thin, small adults that are likely to cool quickly. You need the respiratory component, which is then followed up by a surface component. So the take-home message for the out-of-hospital treatment is the algorithm, which says, you know, when you turn up at a scene, start a clock. Is the water warmer than 6 degrees? Well, yes, it is warmer than 6 degrees. You've probably got a maximum of 30 minutes before it becomes fairly hopeless, if you look at the literature. If the water is below 6 degrees, then that can extend to 90 minutes. And those kinds of timings have now been enshrined into the National Operational Guidance Program for the Fire and Rescue Service, and are currently being revised or reviewed for inclusion in other guidance, including the ambulance service. And I have to say that was first published in 2011. So we're now going into 2024. And although the graph has changed a little bit in terms of it's the way it's presented, the physiology hasn't been found to be wrong. So it's still pretty much 30 minutes, 60 minutes, 90 minutes.
That's brilliant. Thanks, Mike. And yeah, it's certainly fascinating to hear about the case reports of, like they said, that the child in America. I know the pre-hospital community dabbled in a therapeutic hypothermia for medical cardiac arrest ROSC patients for a while. But sadly, exactly as you just explained, there didn't seem to be a benefit more around preventing hyperthermia. But yeah, for the reasons that you just said, clearly there are still these case reports, and sounds like quite a bigger number than I first thought as well. and from the, you said a few thousand cases that you, your team looked at, is that correct?
No, well, we looked at a few thousand cases, but from that, those few thousand cases, we only found around about 20, I think it was 25, which, because we excluded submersion in vehicles, because as soon as there's a vehicle involved, you've got no idea if there's an air pocket. So but when we look, so we found 20, we found 25 or 26 cases. That so for every one of these that occurs, there's literally thousands and thousands that, you know, don't have a good outcome. But the fact that they, they're there means that, you know, people are aware of it, and it's nice to have something to say, okay, well, this is the process we should go through, to give some guidance, because there were different things happening with different agencies. And so that at least this gave a common set of rules to follow, and in particular, some support for stopping search and rescue when water temperatures were high and, you know, you'd been going for 45 minutes and the rescuers were themselves putting themselves at greater and greater risk.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a really, really important point. And coming on to that, I know you were talking about who the survivors are there. Some of our current pre-hospital guidelines, we've obviously got that joint decision model that you spoke about with regards to water temperature and is it a child, and at the various points at which a search and rescue effort can be continued. Some of the pre-hospital guidelines for ambulance service staff currently advocate continuing resuscitation to hospital for any patients that we attend to have had a drowning event. So these are patients in refractory cardiac arrest, regardless of water temperature or body size or anything like that. I just wanted to get your thoughts on that, really. And do you think that these current guidelines are appropriate in this context, given what we've just been talking about?
Yeah, I mean, it's not that much part of my ship, to be honest. It's you'd want to have a look at the underpinning evidence that supports that. I mean, what I would say is that, first of all, because of what we've discussed in terms of drowning being a process that can be continuing and getting worse after you've left the water, then certainly anybody who's anything other than, you know, almost completely unaffected should be transferred to hospital. If there's a chance that their condition is going to deteriorate as they go, then it seems sensible to continue to provide them with some basic life support. What we would say normally, if you're in a circumstance, is that resuscitation can be stopped after 30 minutes of CPR without the return of spontaneous circulation. And that's if the patient is not hypothermic. If there's some uncertainty that there's some cooling occurred, then resuscitation is probably worth continuing. Now, the problem you've got is that it's really difficult to know what somebody's deep body temperature is. And one of the factors that cools you, as we've just heard, is that actually the process of drowning can reduce the body temperature. I do a talk on hypothermia in out of hospital, and I come to the conclusion that the individual in question, if they're still conscious, won't have a clue what temperature their body's at. And the person who comes to them also won't have a clue what temperature their body's at, even if they've got a thermometer. Most of the thermometers that we would use in a out of hospital environment are just of little or no use. And I think people are moving away from that. So if there's any uncertainty, I would say continue resuscitation until you've got a proper measure of body temperature and it's rewarmed to 30 to 34 degrees Celsius. And then continue CPR until asystole is persisted for 20, 30 minutes. I don't care where I go with this, but, you know, there have been reviews of the benefit of certain interventions into things like drowning, into drowning treatment. And the problem we've got in this particular area, there's very little in terms of controlled in terms of controlled comparisons. So, for example, a recent paper by my friend and colleague, two or three of them, published in Resuscitation, Prognostic Factors, 2021, this paper by Joost Beerens, a scoping review, said that there was some evidence for submersion, time to get emergency medical support, and whether it was salt or fresh water. No evidence found regarding resuscitation in water, resuscitation in boats, airway management, oxygen administration, AED use, bystander CPR, ventilation strategy, use of ECMO, discharge protocols. Now, it comes to a general question. I mean, if we take the oxygen one, there's no evidence that providing a suffocating individual with oxygen is a good thing. Why is that? Well, partly it's because there's few comparisons where you have people in the same state that you give some oxygen to and others you don't. And also, you're unlikely to, you know, in most cases, the ones that are getting oxygen are the ones that are fairly far down the road of not being very well. And so I think we have to be kind of careful. And there's an argument where you can work some of these things out from first principles when you have to say, look, there's just not enough epidemiological evidence or controlled epidemiological evidence to come to a viable conclusion. So, yeah, and I think that applies to a lot of what we could talk about in terms of treatment protocols in lots of different areas. And I'm a bit of an advocate for going back to mechanistic first principles. And if I've got somebody who's suffocating, I think I would be giving them oxygen.
I think that's a really good answer around the general use of guidelines and when to continue and when not to continue resuscitation. And my kind of take home from that in summary is that it's very case dependent. I know that there are some pre-hospital critical care teams who would carry core tympanic monitoring, but I guess to sort of look at these, try to make a bigger decision if you try to make an overall clinical picture. But I guess the really key bit is understanding what you've already alluded to in terms of good prognostic factors, who are the survivors, taking all of this into consideration. If you are at that point of 30 minutes still asystolic, whether or not you should go. And in some areas, this might be a 5-10 minute hospital around the corner. In other areas, it could be significantly longer.
Exactly.
There
is no glib, answer, cover all answer. And just to make the point, the studies that we've deliberately done, looking at measuring aural temperature with tympanic thermometers after people have been immersed in cold water, I guarantee there'll be low reading.
Does that include core tympanic monitoring as well? Sorry, core monitoring, so the rectal or esophageal, Michael?
Well, the rectal temperature is often not done correctly. You need to insert the rectal thermistor at least 15 centimetres beyond the anal sphincter. Otherwise, you're just getting intermediate tissue temperature. Anything to do with all the other orifices is going to be affected by the cooling and the water that's been in there. That's why I said earlier that even somebody who turns up to somebody won't have an idea what their temperature is, even if they've got a thermometer. And mostly, they're obviously going to underread. They're going to get artificially low measurements.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. Thank you for clarifying. Just moving on a little bit, some of your other research uncovered a link between unexplained deaths in water and primary arrhythmogenic cardiac arrest, similar to some of the work of Professor Mary Shepherd with cardiac risk in the young. Could you explain a little bit about this autonomic conflict, especially within the context of drowning?
Yes, it's been. That's another name we came up with. We seem to spend quite a lot of time making names up. So, circumrescue collapse, cold shock, autonomic conflict. So, we had noticed in earlier studies where we were actually doing quite applied stuff, looking at people in a helicopter underwater passenger suits during the 1980s for offshore industry, that we were getting some very confused ECGs around the time of them breaking their breath hold underwater. So they would go into the water to hear, they'd be holding their breath as long as they could because they were simulating doing a helicopter underwater escape. But when they broke their breath hold, we would see a lot of arrhythmia. They were often supraventricular, but particularly also occasionally ventricular. These were young, fit, healthy individuals who had no sign of any problems with a 12-lead ECG prior to doing the study. If you do a head-out immersion, you're going to stimulate the cold shock response. And we know that even with young, fit, healthy individuals, you'll see an incidence of arrhythmia of about 1 in 100, maybe 2. If you now put the face in the water, you're now stimulating the ophthalmic division, the trigeminal nerve, and you're inducing a diving response, which, you know, people will know is the response that allows diving mammals to go under the water for many minutes. And it's a bradycardia, a selective vasoconstriction, and an apnea. So you've got the cold shock response. When you go in and you've now gone in the water and the whole of the body's gone in, or you've gone down face first into the water, you've now got the cold shock response trying to increase the heart rate and the force of contraction. And you've got a diving response, a vagal response, trying to decrease the heart rate and force of contraction. And these two are being coincidentally activated. And it's the two arms of the autonomic nervous system, the sympathetic fight or flight response, cold shock response, and the parasympathetic rest and digest vagal response of the diving response. And so that's why we call it autonomic conflict. It's the two arms of the autonomic nervous system. And we found that you could go from an incidence of 1 to 2% to 82% in young, fit, healthy individuals if you added a long breath hold and a break of breath hold in a circumstance where you were getting coincidental stimulation, cold body and cold face. And we found that this was idiosyncratic. So if I put you into cold water and I put you under the water and you come to the surface, break your breath hold, I'll see a certain wave set of arrhythmia that I can see in you time and time again. It's like a signature of your cardiac profile, your ECG profile. So it's a very good way of generating arrhythmia, and it's probably happening all the time in people who are diving into water, putting their face into water, particularly, as I say, if they're associated with the breath hold time. But if they happen to also have ischemic heart disease, myocardial hypertrophy, acquired long QT syndrome, various channelopathies, then we think that they're predisposing factors that increase the likelihood of those arrhythmias descending into something more serious. We've done studies with my friend and colleague, Professor Shattuck, Mike Shattuck from King's, on isolated hearts, simulating this coincidental stimulation of the sympathetic and parasympathetic responses. And we've seen exactly the same arrhythmia as we see in whole body human studies. So it's there, it's something which not just people with predisposing factors that are congenital need to consider, because we now know there are certain drugs that prolong the QT interval, antihistamines, some antiarrhythmics, antibiotics, that will actually increase the likelihood of these arrhythmias occurring if you go into cold water in that way. So about 80% of those that die in triathlon die during the swim. And we think they're not dying when they're training for the swim. So we think the reason for that is increased sympathetic drive, because it's an event and people get a bit angry when they get swum over it. And most of those deaths occurring in the first 400 meters of the swim. And we think also you turn to breathe and you can't take a breath because there's a plume of water over from somebody next to you. So extend your breath hold. And so, you know, it's really a lot of what we do is quite a nice example of you understand the mechanistic physiology and pathophysiology, but then you bring it out and you apply it in the real world. So, you know, you design emergency breathing systems for helicopter passengers so they avoid cold shock. You tell the organizers of triathlons to let people start in waves and don't bring them together too soon, so that you avoid all the factors that are likely to produce autonomic conflict.
It's great. Thanks, Mike. I think it's so interesting being at the clinical end of the spectrum, if you like, and I'm sure I speak for colleagues who work in the pre-hospital community, coming across these patients perhaps and getting a better understanding of exactly what's gone on and what's happened to cause this event, and for us to be able to hopefully help the person in front of us. Talking a little bit more about some of your work and how that's kind of evolved over the years into prevention. I know from speaking to some former colleagues who worked for the RNLI who reviewed CCTV footage of the tragic incident at Bournemouth this summer, that they could see some of the children. I think it was an apparent sandbar collapse, although it sounds like they're still not 100% sure what happened, but they saw on the CCTV footage some of the children floating to live. They were on their back floating. It must have been a real, I'm not sure if you're aware of that or not, but hearing of, no doubt having heard of cases where people are floating to live, must be a real source of pride, and I think a great testament to the work that you and your team have done. Can you talk to us a little bit about the backgrounds of Float to Live? Where did that come from?
So it came very much, Alec, from what we've been talking about, the cold shock response. So we know the cold shock response peaks in the first 30 seconds. You'll have lost control of your breathing. But around about a minute to 90 seconds, those cold receptors adapt and you regain control of your breathing. Just about the worst thing to do in the period where you've lost control of your breathing and you're hyperventilating and gasping is to start thrashing around or swimming hard. Unfortunately, one of the fight or flight aspects of the fight or flight response of the cold shock is that's exactly what you're driven to do. So what we've tried to get people to learn to do is to fight that instinct to wave their arms and thrash around when, and just to lean back, relax and float in the knowledge that that's the best thing to do to protect your airways. Number two, you can float. People think they can't float, but the very vast majority of people can float. Certainly the 5% of the airway of the body that you need to keep above the water will be above the water if you float properly. And that'll be the airway. The trouble is, once you start waving your arms above the water, then the 5% becomes the bit you don't breathe through. So that float to live. I mean, the first experiment we did, and just gives you some idea of the lead time, was in 1986, where we looked at people going into the water and doing nothing for 2 minutes before they started to try and swim. And they were much more successful than those that tried to swim whilst they had lost control of their breathing. We've worked with the, next year will be the 40th anniversary of working with the RNLI, and it's the 200th anniversary of the RNLI. And if anybody is really interested, they can go on and listen to 200 Voices, which is the 200 days leading up to the 200th anniversary of the RNLI in March. They've had every day somebody talking about the RNLI and how they've interacted with them and worked with them. And in this particular instance, mine was number 75. I've said exactly what I've said here, that we've been working with the RNLI, we've been feeding information in. But the really important thing for me is that they can then take that information and turn it into a public health campaign that is now internationally renowned. And the problem with preventative medicine, if you like, as you know, is that it's quite hard when it's a complex thing like drowning, where the numbers go up and down for all kinds of reasons, to find out what impact your particular intervention has had. But, you know, the RNLI and ourselves have now had, in excess of 50 unsolicited contacts saying, I did that and I think it saved my life. I just floated. And you can go online, you can listen to Evan's story, you can listen to a whole host of those that the RNLI, those stories that the RNLI have now turned into educational videos to try and get others to do this. So that's where it comes from. It comes from an understanding of the neurophysiology of cold water immersion and the best behavioral thing to do in terms of counteracting and mitigating that threat. And that's what we pretty much do with every extreme environmental threat. We look to what can we do technologically. In cold water, it's an emergency breathing system, which we've developed for helicopter passengers. What you can do behaviorally, float first, or what you can do physiologically, cold habituation, which we've taught all three of which we've now talked about this today.
That's awesome. Thanks, Mike. And hopefully that's brought it all put it all nicely together. Just as we come into land on this episode, I was just hoping you could maybe tell us a little bit about the work that you've done with organisations such as the RNLI and have been involved in drowning prevention. Just a little bit about why is this so important and what are the current challenges that these organisations face with regards to effectively dealing with drowning prevention?
For me, the one of the joys of the kind of science we do is that, yes, we look at things, you know, the laboratory boffin type thing, you know, looking at neurophysiological pathways, looking at responses to heat, to cold, to altitude, to microgravity, and to cold water. But we also have that application where we have a link with groups, Fire and Rescue Service, RNLI, the forces, you know, where we can actually say we think that this is the best way to mitigate this response. And that working relationship is absolutely critical because it allows us to see our work and our understanding of the basic physiology being implemented in ways that we just couldn't do without working with groups like the RNLI, like Surf Life Saving GB, like the Coast Guard, like the RNLSS. And so we work with all of those groups. And that relationship has been ongoing now, as I say, for many decades. And I think we can point to some successes. We call it the overall term is from lab to life-saving. We'll do all the lab stuff and we'll come up with the ideas and we'll come up with the underpinning science. But that has to be then turned into an educational program, a drowning prevention program. And that's the strength of those other organizations. The problems, for me, that a really important end of the spectrum is the prevention end. Because whilst I know it's sexy to go and hang out of a helicopter and pick somebody out and resuscitate them and do out-of-hospital resuscitation and then in-hospital resuscitation, if you look at the cost per life save, the preventative end is a really important end to get sorted out. You're not going to get data on that so much. So what we've been trying to do is to get just three messages into the national curriculum at around about the age of 13 or 14, which is where you see the inflection point of drowning starting with young people because they start trying doing things. And that's to teach them about tides, to not get cut off by the tides. That's to teach them about rips, about how to avoid a rip or what to do if you're in a strong current. And it's about cold shock and float to live. And we think that that lesson for life is something that you could teach in 15 minutes in a school, and that would people should take that with them for the rest of their lives. Unfortunately, it's like trying to break into Fort Knox, trying to get into the national curriculum. So we have to do it by word of mouth, by people talking to others, by educational programs. I think one of the problems in the sector is that all these different organizations with the very best of intentions all have their own little plans, their own strategies, their own little educational programs. And sometimes it can be a bit overwhelming. The message can get a bit diluted because it's coming in so many different ways from so many different groups. And that's why, again, it would be nice to have something that was more central and that we were putting out one or two or three critical messages. But that's just not the way it is. It's a bit too disintegrated, I'm afraid, for that at the moment.
Mike, that's brilliant. Thank you so much for your time. Really, really appreciate it. Some great stuff in there.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care podcast on the Medics Academy Network.